Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 31. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with guest author, blogger, and champion of simple living, Bob Seitz. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It is not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, but not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, which is also our closing theme song. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I discussed the standards in episode 2. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith, first, to challenge consumerism, two, to live justly, and three, to celebrate responsibly. Through the Internet, we extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video, and links are listed in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. I'm glad you're with me today. Well, in addition to authoring numerous books, Bob Seitz blogs as Simple Enough several times a week for the Lutheran Magazine Online. You don't need to be a subscriber to read his blog, but you do need to subscribe in order to make comments. His writings are on the Simple Living Works site, include the series Beyond Simplicity and the Advent meditation Be Unafraid, Be Very Unafraid. The links to these are in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. So, Bob, we've known each other quite a while through the Hunger Program at the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and through Alternatives for Simple Living, when you were our champion at getting grants for our operation, for which I'm forever grateful. You and I retired about the same time, right at the end of 2007, beginning of 2008.
Yes, that's true.
Now, we can go back and, you know, talk about some history, but let's start there and talk about what you've been up to since then. I understand you've written a couple more books and that you're a regular columnist for the Lutheran Magazine Online.
First of all, I did retire exactly at the end of January 2008, which was a 20-year, to the day, 20-year anniversary of my beginning work at the ELCA. And when I retired, I was the director for hunger education, a position that's been changed ever so slightly, but continues. And in that position, what I did was to help the constituency of the ELCA to learn about the root causes of hunger. At that time, the ELCA was still operating off of hierarchy, but it was certainly a collection of goals, one of which included the idea that the root cause of hunger was the lifestyles of people in this country. And so I was emboldened and, in my mind, called to do that well, knowing that I had known Alternatives back when it was still located outside of Atlanta when I worked for the LCA. Knowing that that was true, it felt good for me to focus a good share of the effort of our hunger education on lifestyle matters, although there are other causes of hunger that are certainly beyond our control, war and pestilence and matters of weather. The matter of Western lifestyle certainly is something that we can help each other with. And so because of my own proclivities as a Christian and also because of the goals of that hunger program, I concentrated very heavily during the 4 years I was hunger education director, concentrated very heavily on making sure that lifestyle matters are something that remains strong in the life of the church. Alternatives doing that so well and producing so many resources and having such a good audience, it made good sense to us all of us there to use some of the grant money that we had to support and encourage alternatives. And for a short time, I was on the board, which was an exhilarating experience, Jerry, and I enjoyed that. Back to your question, what have I been doing? Since then, I have, that was 2008. I think I wrote another book between now and then, but I'm not sure. That's a bad joke, forgetful offer of the joke. I think what I wrote actually was a collection of my blogs. I'll talk about those a little bit. The Lutheran Magazine, which is the flagship magazine for the ELCA, has a monthly magazine called The Lutheran, and it goes out to hundreds of thousands of people across the country, and as a part of its website has a few blogs. I was fortunate enough to be asked to be one of those bloggers by a good friend who's also one of the section editors. And so in May of, I'm not sure what year it was, I started writing blogs, 300 words only in length, on the subjects that lie under the idea of simple living. And as you and I both know, as anybody listening to this knows, simplicity is not a simple question. And when you start unpacking what it means to live simply, you run into hundreds of other subjects. And so what I thought would be just a few months has now turned into about 300, 400, maybe 500 or 600 of these blogs, which have now come out about once every 3 days. And they're, I can tell you a little bit more about them if that would be helpful, but back to the book. What happened with the blogs is, I decided that they were so wonderfully written. Pause for laughter. They were so wonderfully written. That might be a good idea for my publisher at that time, Alban Institute, to try them out as a new kind of a book and a new kind of format. They had not ever done, completely just done an e-book. And so what I did is I collected 150 of those blogs together, put them into a kind of a calendar as though it were a book of devotions, and put those, sent those to my publisher, who reconstituted them as a an ebook. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was called Starting Simple, which is the name of the blog. But anyhow, that's the last book that I actually have written, and the blogs continue to this day.
Well, I need to step back a little bit, Bob. Thanks for that background. The when you say lifestyle ministry, I think we need to unpack that a little bit further, because I think you're talking about things like overconsumption, for example.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And but you might want to unpack that a little bit more. What's all involved in a lifestyle ministry?
Well, let's start back. I was born in a log cabin in California in 1942. You know, how far do you want to go back, Jerry? You and I both know that this is, back to the question, what isn't? The ways that we live our lives in every aspect, inside of our culture, inside of our minds, inside of our families, inside of organizations, certainly in our vocations, and in everything that we do. There's a style, there's a format, there's a set of habits that become ingrained, and it has a shape and a fashion to it, hence style, that we tend to stick to. And so as we live our lives, which is a very large term, deep and broad, as we live our lives, we live according to certain styles. They're framed by our income levels, by our education. They're certainly framed by our context. They may even be framed by our genetics or by our neurobiology. But those styles, whatever they are, determine how we make the decisions, economic decisions, which may be the only decisions that really exist. We make our economic decisions, and under that we make our decisions about our own identity, our sense of well-being, our sense of purpose and meaning. All of that encompassed by the idea of a style of living. And finally, our styles of living, because we live in communities, none of us is a hermit most of the time, except for you people out there who are still staying on the poles or living in your cave. The rest of us live in community, and so our lifestyle becomes aggregated with other lifestyles and infects and affects everything around us. And so where I sit right now, I am not very far away from a chain of grocery stores that's owned by a German company that trades things like Joe's. And that particular company is where I shop because I have chosen to eat a certain way. So those of us who have a lifestyle of eating that way and consuming that way of food gather together to enable that market chain to be all over the country and to employ people and coincidentally to give its excess food to our church and to our food pantry in town. So my lifestyle, aggregated with other lifestyles, becomes the lifestyle that infects and affects others, in this case, all over my community. So it's never an individual thing, and it's always open to question and examination, and I think that's what you and I, and again, those folks who are listening, that's what we do. That's we not only try to live our life in a style that is modeled on Christ and on God's will, but we also understand that whatever we do creates ripples and roots and seeds for other folks' lifestyles.
Well, I think we're fond of using the expression, all things are connected. And so yep. What you're talking about far exceeds just your community. It affects people all around the world. And our lavish lifestyle has an impact on impoverished people around the world.
Yeah, and it certainly doesn't do very well for our health. I think one of the things that you and I discovered early on, and what Alternatives was so insistent on, long before you and I ever came on the scene, is that lifestyle also includes some attitudes. And so Alternatives, which could have descended into the mud and muck of despondency and ain't it awful, Alternatives always had this idea, as you do now in your particular way of carrying on that ministry. We live joyfully, and we live hopefully, and we live gratefully, and we live generously. And so living lavishly it hurts people around the world, and that's what hunger education was about. But it also hurts us. We know that people that sit around as couch potatoes and eat bonbons are taking years off of their life, new research. We know that people that don't exercise get heart disease and diabetes. We know that people who are overweight are killing themselves and probably giving a bad example to their children. We know that people who move too fast are always stressed and their cortisol levels are ruining parts of their brain. So the manner of lifestyle not only affects the economic well-being and the health of people around the world, but it also kills us. And so it's almost oxymoronic that any of us should be living a lifestyle that's lavish or overconsumptive, because we're killing ourselves. And the deeper roots of that particular statement and matter are something that still puzzles me. Why do people do things that they know, incontrovertibly, they know is hurting them? Why do we over-consume potato chips? Why do we drink too much soda? Why do we rush around? Why do we drive too fast? These are things that hurt us, and in hurting us, they hurt our capacity to carry out God's will. Why do we do that? Again, back to matters of habit, identity, history, things that the church can address, and certainly that God has a lot to say in the scriptures.
I've worked with lots of denominations over the years with Alternatives and now with Simple Living Works. And what I have found, so I'm not picking on the ELCA, is that a number of the mainline denominations are backing away from lifestyle ministry. They are focusing more on crises, global crises, which are very important. and I don't mean to diminish them. In talking to some of the denominational leaders, I'm hearing talk such as, well, we need to let the younger generation decide how they're going to deal with lifestyle ministry. Are you getting a sense of this as well, and how are you responding to this?
I'm glad to hear you say that, Jerry, because I have been afraid for these past 4 years that my observations, which match yours hand in glove, were only the evidence of one of those old guys who left, and now everybody who's left behind is not as smart as he was. But I think that observation is correct, and I see it evidenced in a variety of places. A couple of comments. First of all, I understand why it happened. Denominations, mainline especially, and perhaps all of them, have had to cut back on staff. And as older staff have retired, people who have, in the matter of hunger education, for example, who have gone through years of development and maturing and understanding of the subject, have retired. Some of that institutional knowledge stops with them. When they leave, the knowledge is gone. And so the people who come in have to kind of start over at the beginning. The early evidences, for example, of alternatives, or the early examples of the hunger education movement, were all pretty basic and pretty actually wrong. And it took 20 or 30 years for denominations to come to a simple thing like, you know, I'm going to live simply so that others can simply live, or that generosity is based on gratitude. Those are things that took decades for to be discovered and to come down into the warp and the woof of congregations. So with new staff members coming in, with the old ones gone, and with denominations, frankly, having not enough staff to do the work that they used to do, they've had to triage. Denominations have had to triage. What will we concentrate on? Well, what gets people's attention, quite honestly, are crises. It's true in hunger. It's true in any kind of a ministry. The congregation's running out of money. All of a sudden, we got a big crisis. Let's go and take care of the crisis. Unfortunately, what this does is it sets up short-term goals. It sets short-term outcomes. It sets up emotion-only reactions. It shuts off people's ability to reason and think more deeply about what really is necessary. And what happens in these particular cases is denominations and congregations are losing out, one, on a necessity that needs to be covered that goes beyond immediate necessities. So they have lost their long-term view, much as corporations have who are only trying to look at a quarter-by-quarter stock market report. But more importantly, and this is the critical one and something you and I have talked about and many of the listeners know, the generation coming up, not the ones who swill beer and get drunk every night at their college, but the rest of them, when they grow up, when they get out of college, when they don't go to college, when they realize what their parents have done to them and what kind of a world they're going to inherit, a good portion of young adults today are on board with the ideas of simple living. You don't have to go to Seattle to figure that out. And in every big city and every farm community and every suburb, there is a growing group of young adults who, seeing the world as it truly is, have themselves started to wrestle with the question, how do we live more simply? I live in a pretty affluent suburb and in a pretty affluent congregation. And that strong river of thought exists in my congregation. It's palpable. It shows up in our programs. It shows up in our conversations. Now, here's back to the why is this so awful. What denominations have done is to cut themselves off from a very logical, very appealing strand of thought and practice that would bring in the young adults that denominations so dearly want to have as a part of the church. And conversely, what's happening is young adults coming to the church and seeing them do the same old thing they did 30 years ago, taking care of the next crisis or chasing the fat of the month, young adults are saying, the church doesn't get it. And so why should I be a part of an organization that's retro in every way and that's not addressing the present and the future needs of the entire world? So there's a double tragedy going on here. What needs to be done isn't getting done by denominations, and they're losing out. Denominations are losing out on a wonderful opportunity to speak to, attract, draw in, and involve in ministry a young adult population that's desperately seeking for what the church could offer.
Thank you for those insights, Bob. I also see well-educated young adults who are getting involved in CSAs or community-supported agriculture, who are getting involved in homesteading and in other ways just in community gardens and those kinds of things.
Yeah, those are all good markers of this, but another marker, here's a recent one. A Scottish hamburger company whose clownish mascot Ronald is desperate. This particular corporation has found that its sales in restaurants across this country are down, moderately so, 3 or 4%. But where the sales are really down is among young adults, the 18 to 25 class. Young adults are not buying fast food from that corporation anymore. There's a sign that something's happening.
Now, Bob, I'd like to mention that, if I'm correct, anyone can read your blog at thelutheran.com, but in order to comment,
right,
they need to subscribe to thelutheran.com. Is that correct?
They can comment that way, yeah, and they can subscribe. There's a secret way to comment, and always, Jerry, thank you for your comments. Those are always, I get so few that when I get one, I know that it's Jerry giving me an attaboy or telling me about something that's happening at Simple Living Works. So that's great. I appreciate what you've done. Yeah, here's the other way you can comment. Somewhere on that blog site, when you go to Lutheran, you hit blogs, and then I'm right there on the Bob sites. Somewhere there, you can click on my name and find my email address. And so I'm not desperate for emails, nor am I desperate for Twitters or Facebook or LinkedIn or anything else. I don't want to have a wave of people asking me good questions because we'll get into long conversations. But if people want to comment, they can find my email address and send me an email. And I've gotten a few of those.
But the difference is that in that case, those will not be public.
Those will not be public.
The
yeah.
comments that are made on thelutheran.com will be public.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. The Lutheran would love to have an open comment line, but if you go to most blogs in most denominations, you will see the same thing happening. Where the comments thing is, go down there and click on it, and you'll see zero. Most blogs don't get commented on for a couple of reasons. Blogs are not the preferred way of communication among a whole cohort of our civilization. That's one. Two, organizations don't have the staff to sit there and monitor all their Facebook inputs, all their Twitter inputs, all their Instagram inputs, all their blog inputs. That's a staff member that has to sit there and watch the screen and monitor the phone calls that come in, the responses that come in. When you're down in staff already, you're not about to dedicate a staff member to watching a screen all day. And this is true in the Lutheran magazine. That's the reason why they don't allow for the tweets or the responses online. And most organizations don't do that. This is one of those unintended consequences that we talk about with lifestyle. We cannot, any of us, deliver on the promise that if you send me a message, I'll answer you back. And then the bigger the corporation, the more true that is. If you don't think that's true, try to get a hold of the folks at Walmart by email. That's a challenge. And if any of your listeners think they can do it, all I can say is good luck. Walmart has figured out they don't have the time or the staff to answer every email that comes. So the Lutheran's in the same position, and maybe it it's a portent of the future to say, gee, could we pick up the phone or write each other a letter?
I'd like to also mention, Bob, that within your blog series, which, like you say, comes out maybe three times a week, you have mini series. And one of those mini series is about church leadership or conducting business within the church. So you talk briefly about your mini series.
Thank you. Excellent question. When I first started doing it, it was just, you know, I'm sort of a whimsical guy. And so I thought, you know, I'll poke fun at a couple of things and I'll give people some information. Your blog and your email blast, Jerry, are always very informational. And if I ever need to find a place where I can go to get resources, you have carried on that banner very well. I realized that I couldn't do that besides you're already doing it. So what I decided to do is make my blogs kind of whimsical light, because that's a way to get people's attention. If you are too heavy, and I certainly can be, and you're too morose, and I certainly can be, you don't attract people to this idea of simple living. So I decided to keep it light. But what I noticed over time is that there were subjects that kept coming up and audiences that I felt I was missing. And so I added a sub blog on for parents and people who have children, caregivers of parents. So I call that Simplicity's Children. There's a whole series of those. The one that you mentioned about congregations, I call it Simple Congregations. And about once a month, there's a blog, a little bit longer, that can help you as a leader of a congregation to think about how simplicity could be valuable to your organization. So this month, in October or September, whatever month this is, I put a whole bunch of posts on how to do stewardship simply. And then another one has been a blog that I call Simple Things, which occurred to me one day when I was watering the lawn or something, and thinking, here's this sprinkler that spreads water all over my whole lawn. And in the past, people would have had to go to draw out the well and sprinkle water around by hand. And so I realized that in our lifestyles, we have all these wonderfully complex and amazing tools and artifacts of our civilization that we take for granted. And so yesterday I wrote one about the shovel. What a wonderful thing a shovel is. And the idea on that one is simply this. As we handle objects and use the artifacts of our civilization, we should be grateful for these things who have come down to us over generations and for the wonderful things they do. And in seeing them, these simple things, as valuable and astounding and complicated and beneficial to our lives, we can learn to appreciate them more. Therefore, we won't throw them away so quickly. Therefore, we will treasure them and guard them and take care of them. And in that way, we will also live simply. So those are the sub things that I've done. There may be another one that I'm forgetting, but those are the sub blogs that I've done.
Well, Bob, you've worked a lot with language. That's one of your specialties. And also, if I'm correct, with the brain. And a number of your writings have been about neurolinguistics or something of that field. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you would.
The axiom that guides me there is no words, N-O words, no thoughts. And then the opposite of it is no words, K-N-O-W words, no thoughts. Neurolinguistics or psycholinguistics have taught us that words are what happens. As we know words, thoughts are possible. As we put words together, so we put thoughts together. And so I've been very insistent in my own ministry. I'm a wordsmith, I'm a writer, to look at language and the way that we use it, and to be very careful, perhaps overly clever sometimes, in the way that I use language. For example, I have studied for years, I've studied the dimensions, the power and the use of humor, and what humor does inside of our brains. And so when I say that I'm whimsical, it's not because I'm a screwball from California, which I am, but it's also that I know the value of humor, and I know what it does to release endorphins, and I know what it does to bond us with other people, and I know that humor is a whole brain activity that helps us deal with and celebrate and avoid the absurd. And having studied brain science since 1975 and written about it too for churches, I'm convinced that it's one of the ways that we can understand simple living, getting at some of the questions that vex us over and over again. And knowing some of those things, perhaps we can try to ameliorate the basic conditions. For example, the dynamics of habit. We know that very well now, what constitutes habits and how you change habits. All of a sudden now, change theory is broken down into manageable chunks and actions that we can take to counter bad habits. Well, knowing that language is a part of habituation, I think that any of us who work in simple living can start to examine our own language and examine the language of others. And as we change our language, so our thoughts will change, and so will our actions. And so that's why I have studied it, continue to study it, and in my own ministry, at least, to try to be insistent that wordsmithing is a part of what I do at every occasion, and especially when they're written in a readable form.
Excellent. Can you give us a little preview of your upcoming book that you're working on about stewardship, or is this premature?
No, it's not. My first joke, and my bad joke, is, which I've done for years, is the book is called Bible Lands Near and Far. Years ago, that was my film strip joke. But it's not Bible Lands Near and Far, because that's actually a lie. There's no such thing as a Bible land near. But the name of the book is Stewardshift, S-H-I-F-T. And my basic premise is this. It has a subtitle. I haven't figured out what it is. But the basic premise is this. The whole matter of stewardship, of which simple living is a part, was originally a secular term from first century B.C. Greece. Paul picks it up and writes about it in a very small and slight way when he's trying to find some metaphors for the Christ-like life. And so he takes this economic metaphor, the steward, from first century B.C. Greece, and he incorporates it into his part of the Christian message. Over the centuries, that use has been magnified and corrupted, quite honestly, by the church, because the church needs money. And so even when the Anglo-Saxon term steward came about, we corrupted that one too, because we needed money. And so what I'm trying to do in this book is to say, stewardship ministries and congregations, which may be not going as well as we'd hope, and I don't mean just that contributions are flat or down, but that people still don't grasp stewardship as something good and noble and grateful and joyful and life-building, that stewardship ministries and congregations could be enhanced or strengthened from their present state by us going back into the secular world and saying, who, even though they're not members of our church and even though they're not trained in theology, who understands stewardship? And what could we learn from them, just like Paul did? And so I'm looking at natural history. I'm looking at neurobiology. I'm looking at fundraisers and philanthropists. I'm looking at change theory. I'm looking at wisdom literature, wisdom research. And, of course, I'm looking at lifestyle. And there will be a chapter in that book on how do we learn from lifestyle adherents, people who are helping us examine lifestyle? How could that be a part of the stewardship of congregations? The book is for congregation leaders, and it's a book whose purpose and outcome scare me a little bit, because I am going to be suggesting that we shift from what we're doing now, even in gentle and positive ways, from what we have been doing in the past, and that could be difficult or even threatening, I think, to some folks, because the questions that I'm asking are harder, and the answers that I expect are not going to be the answers that we've always heard. So I'm writing it with necessary humility and necessary fear that any author should have, but also a great hope that these things that I've discovered, again, lifestyle being one of them, that they will be beneficial to people who are trying to make their congregations beneficial to their members.
We'll look forward to that, Bob. Do you have a release date in mind?
Thank you. The publisher will be Morehouse, which is an Episcopal house coming out of New York. It's an imprint, actually, of Church Publishing, Inc., looking at the fall of 2015.
Very good.
You've been listening to my conversation with author, blogger, and champion of simple living, Bob Seitz. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to feedback@simplelivingworks.org or simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or comment on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. All those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. In response to my blog, Simple Living Humor? What's that? Charlie Kyle said, "Thanks, Gerald, for a very clever and nicely drawn lesson about the constant state insufficiency felt by those of us who live for more and more accumulation. Your cartoon is worth 1,000 words." Although Jesus did a pretty good job of sharing that idea in 133 words in the parable of the rich young fool in Luke 12, verses 16 to 21. Best, Charlie, from Chicago. In my response to another summer blog, Charlie wrote, "Your beatitude-driven lifestyle and your ink drawing of the crucified Christ are very inspirational. Thank you for sharing." In my response to my blog about fall festival helps, including the classic for simplifying Christmas, Unplug the Christmas Machine, Judy L. Jernberg wrote, "I taught that book, Unplug, for years. It is still more than helpful." I've begun the hopefully interactive blog Ask Slim, inspired by a recent note. I hope that you'll read my response in my Simple Living Works blog entitled, "Feeling Bullied by Consumo? Ask Slim." Then add your own ideas, and you can ask questions or make comments or even make confessions about other broadly simple living topics. The links are in the podcast show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, or go directly to the blog at simplelivingworks.org, window number 2. By the way, both Consumo and Slim are characters I invented for a skit called Consumo Must Go. Consumo is the overlord of overconsumption, and Slim is the common sense antidote to that anti-hero. Slim is an acronym, by the way, for Simple Living is More. You're welcome to use the skit this fall in your church or group. It's one of Simple Living Works' many free resources, or as we say, free sources, on our website. Remember to add your ideas to Ask Slim and offer your own questions and confessions, too. In episodes 32 through 35 in November and December, I'll present an audio version of Whose Birthday Is It Anyway?, our best-known annual resource. Regular listeners may think, didn't we hear that last year? Well, Alternatives produced some 25 editions, so this year's is different from last year's. Even though Whose Birthday is no longer produced on paper, we still publish an online edition. Be watching for that. If you want to contribute an article or a piece of art, take a look at the guidelines. Send it in right away electronically if possible. That's one thing that's nice about online publishing. It can be modified at any time. Well, time to wrap up episode number 31 of Simple Living Works. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. We'd love to get to know you as a subscriber to this podcast and to the blogs we post new each week. Subscriptions are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Remember to like us on Facebook and urge your friends to do the same. You can also subscribe to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, at iTunes. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All of our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send me your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. Find details in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Then click About. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution License. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can live.